Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for April 22nd, 2019, the day after Easter, Easter Monday. We are not having a video option for this week.
But we're going to try and do it this later, but or not for the next podcast.
But it's not appropriate for us to be on film.
The way we would have done it.
What? I mean, if you tried to film me right now, I would literally and metaphorically kill you. Because
the way this works is we have to have a time during the week when we record
where we're awake and
yeah, and you feel like you're, I don't know,
presentable. Dressed. I don't know. Presentable. I comb my hair.
Yeah.
I was thinking about brushing my teeth today, but I don't know. But
when we do it, it's good because we don't have the.
Do you have words today?
No.
So.
The pressure of doing it.
Yeah, because we want to be there for our fan and everything. So we're here in season and out of season. I don't know, today feels like out of season, but we're going to recap Easter, a holy week, and we're also going to go through that fantastic New York Times interview.
With Union Seminary President, Serene Jones, I think is her name.
I'm sorry, but she's not a woman of color, so why is she even being interviewed about the Easter worshiping option? Twitter came through for me this weekend. Yeah. I was pretty happy about Twitter.
People were disbelieving. They didn't express disbelief, but they looked disbelieving yesterday during Christian education when I was telling them about how within liberal Protestantism, people actually don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead.
And they thought, that's stupid.
And the virgin birth and all of that people just don't believe it. No. And they just pour, unorthodox words or heretical meaning into orthodox words. And no, I mean, the people think it's
why
just like this
do that?
Small, maybe the professors I had.
Yeah.
But not in general. Yep. But no, this is Union Seminary President. Union Seminary is...
Yeah, where is that? Isn't it in...
I don't know where it is.
Pennsylvania somewhere.
I don't know, but it's like it's a famous... It was at one time supposed to be a very good, or decent seminary, but now it's just, we'll see.
Like, how long ago was it a decent seminary?
I don't know. A long, long time ago. Probably back when the Episcopal Church was a decent church.
So.
We're like...
50 years
or
something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, well, should we lead in with that and then recast our Holy Week? Cast is not the word I'm looking for. Later.
Okay.
I mean, should we just go straight in?
Let's do that.
First of all, I did love the Twitter tweetings because, there's a horrible bombing of Christians in Sri Lanka, and so important politicians got on Twitter and said, our hearts... thoughts and prayers for Easter worshipers.
So right, you're noticing nobody, liberal politicians weren't saying Christians.
You can't say
Christians the word were Christian. Slaughtered. So, it's Easter worshipers.
So
what does that mean?
I think that's the person who worships Easter eggs and the bunny.
Well, this Serena Jones of Union Theological Seminary thinks that people are obsessed with the resurrection. We just stop being so obsessed with the resurrection.
It's stupid.
Yeah.
So
maybe we're Easter worshippers. Maybe that's what they mean.
People who are obsessed with the resurrection are Easter worshippers. Like we're like Bible worshippers.
Yeah.
We worship the Bible.
Yeah.
And the resurrection, because that's really
that's
dumb.
Ridiculous.
So
here's Nicholas Kristof. He's a New York Times columnist, and this was. For the day, right? But this is published April 20th, which is the day before Easter. And so he has Here's his intro. This is the latest in my occasional series of conversations about Christianity. Here's my interview edited for space with Serene Jones, a Protestant minister, president of Union Theological Seminary, and author of a new memoir, Call It Grace. She has a memoir. She doesn't say so.
So she's an important person.
Yeah, yeah. So here's Christoph. Happy Easter, Reverend Jones. To start, do you think of Easter as a literal flesh and blood resurrection? I have problems with that. I do wonder what the problems are. I'd like to hear him say what his problems are.
He didn't say what his problems were. He invited her to launch into what her problems were, which they are legion.
Right. I mean, just logically starting off, if a person believes that God exists, then it's not implausible. Nicholas Kristof believes that God exists, and so he needs to have some...
Does he, though?
He does. He goes on and says he does. Well,
God is it that exists?
You know, apparently, Serene Jones says that she believes that God exists, so she needs to have reasons why she disbelieves what the founding documents of her religion.
I mean, does she her framed religion does she say. Need to have reasons, or can she just kind of go with it? I don't feel like she really needs to have reasons. Like, I feel like her heart is gonna tell her everything that she needs.
Well, here's what she says. You're right.
That's true.
Yeah, when you look at the Gospels, the stories are all over the place. There's no resurrection story in Mark; just an empty tomb. Okay, now that itself is kind of funny, right?
It's awesome.
Because so what does she think the story of Mark is trying to communicate? In verse 8, let's just assume that the larger ending is not part of Mark's original gospel. What does she think?
Well, the women
leaving the tomb empty after being told by the angels explicitly, he's risen. What does that mean?
It means...
Or angel. There's only one angel anymore.
That they had a feeling of resurrection in their hearts. And that that feeling carried them through until they died.
And I love the first... When you look at the Gospels, the stories are all over the place.
What stories?
I think she means the resurrection stories are all over the
stories.
Place.
The stories. So the Bible is full of stories. Yeah, or story. Sorry, story.
Story, not story. If you put the article in front of it,
it doesn't count.
Yeah, the Bible is story.
This podcast is going to be full of me cackling because I'm tired.
So this I think counts for well. Look, if we have differing stories, if we have accounts that differ a little bit, then obviously we can just discount them all.
Right, every single one of them is wrong.
Right. I mean that I remember hearing that argument too in seminary, and of course they wouldn't say they differ; they'd say they were contradictory. But they don't contradict; they just differ. And so, if our kids all have the same story, I mean that's when you disbelieve them.
Yeah.
If they all say, if you come in, why is the room a mess? And then they all exactly say the same exact word for word thing, then
they're all lying.
That's the point. So the fact that their stories differ is a sign of authenticity, not a sign of inauthenticity.
Do you feel like part of the problem with modern day religious wandering is that nobody knows, like the nuances of human relationships have been flattened. The nuances of just communicating with other human people have been flattened to such a degree that probably partly by social media, but also just by, you can't have facial expression or, eye contact communicating anything in ordinary human. So when you go to a text, you can't imagine that there might be a lot of subtlety and depth, and the way things are communicated could be really fascinating.
Right. So you see that with the woman in the Syrophoenician woman.
Right.
Who, Jesus can't possibly be encouraging her with his eyes.
Or sarcastic. Scoring off the crowd. Yeah. Or, there can't be multi-layered communication.
Right.
It has to be flat.
Right.
And therefore, dumb.
This next line is wonderful. So this is still her answer to the question. Those who claim to know whether or not it happened are kidding themselves. Like, you know, the ones who actually saw it.
The ones who saw Jesus like Paul, in the garden.
Paul, you're kidding yourself.
You know how he rose, when he rose from the dead.
Mary Magdalene, kidding
saw
herself.
Saw them, and they actually grabbed his feet, and like how they saw and ate food with the resurrected Christ. They are
kidding themselves. It's really remarkable that like 2,000 years later, a liberal seminary president
knows,
can look back 2,000 years into survey documents written by people who saw the thing and just say nonchalantly, well, they're kidding themselves.
They just don't know.
It's a bit.
I know how to do history, TM. Yeah. Nobody knows how to do history. Like, have you literally never taken a history class? Take a history class, lady.
This is really, and I do. Okay, now there's some controversy about that Cho quote where he said, they should believe women of color.
So maybe he was being sarcastic.
Maybe he was being sarcastic about this, but yeah, she should believe the women.
I know. I saw that her, all right? on Twitter. Right. Hashtag believe the women. Hello, at least this time, believe right. women.
Right. No, they're kidding themselves, though.
Yeah, they are.
But that
that is so disrespectful. Right? How dare you disbelieve right. women?
Their experiences.
Who are
their
you?
Voice. You're putting.
Who are you? Plus, you know what, lady? You're not even a woman of color, so how dare you? Yeah.
But that empty tomb symbolizes the ultimate love in our lives cannot... Wait. That empty tomb symbolizes that the ultimate love in our lives cannot be crucified and killed.
What is the ultimate love? Is that the greatest love of all? Is that like Whitney Houston?
I don't know.
And that cannot be crucified or killed. The greatest love of all, the love of myself.
So this must mean that for the disciples, their deep love for Jesus, even though he died,
I think they're talking,
can't be killed because they
but
love.
But I'm sure it's themselves that they love.
Right, because Jesus is just really
a
metaphor for you.
A metaphor for you.
For me, it's impossible to tell the story of Easter without also telling the story of the cross. Well, that's true. The crucifixion is...
For me. For me, it's impossible. Really. For me, I like to add just a little hint of saffron to my shrimp. For me, that's what works best. A little bit of cream right at the end.
For me, I like the baby Jesus.
For me, I like the baby Jesus. Well, I actually like the Jesus that wears the tuxedo t-shirt because it says, I'm
like serious,
to party.
But I can like to party. Sometimes.
I like to party.
So for me, it's impossible to tell the story of Easter without also telling the story of the cross. The crucifixion is a first century lynching. Ah, okay. That's why it's important.
So Jesus was a person of color.
Right.
Incidentally, that's true. That's true.
He was. But he was also lynched by people of color.
Yeah. Like they were all, there were so, no so, white
well, no, wait,
people.
No, wait, the Italians. I'm sorry. He was lynched by Europeans. The people of color handed him over to the Europeans. There's whiteness through that whole story.
There is.
the whiteness of the... Yeah, you know, they're actually all white.
Right, because it's systems of power. It's
right.
actually not...
It's all whiteness.
It's not the actual color of your skin. It's the
right.
systems of power
right.
that are white. And so, yeah, Jesus was definitely lynched. it was a race thing.
Right.
Definitely
it was all about race. Yeah. So
it couldn't be more pertinent to our world.
Around today.
Incidentally, it is still very pertinent.
Like, yes,
I feel
is.
Like the cross, for me, the cross is really pertinent in our world today. And the story of the cross.
Story, not the story.
Sorry.
Story of the cross.
Of cross. But.
So okay. now Nicholas Kristof asks a reasonable question. But without a physical resurrection, isn't there a risk that we are just left with the crucifixion?
No, you dummy.
Crucifixion is not something that God is orchestrating from upstairs.
What? Upstairs? Because God is the weirdo in the attic.
Yeah, God had no idea. It was like totally, oh, what are you doing? Stop, that's my son. Get your hands off him. Quit.
I sent him there because I thought, you know how there was that story of how the father sent all those people into the vineyard and they killed one, and then he said to himself, he was like, I'll send my son. Surely, so maybe she's actually reading the Bible. Surely they'll respect my son.
Except that Jesus told that story before.
No, I know.
Before
he was crucified. But again, we can't understand that story because, like, we can't understand the nuance and the subtlety of that story, how Jesus told the story in the temple right before he was handed over, because, like, we don't understand words and things like that.
Right. And if you do, you're kidding yourself. The crucifixion is not something that God is orchestrating from upstairs. Except, again, Acts.
Like, he's literally orchestrating it. He's literally orchestrating everything.
That God literally.
Not even just metaphorically, but, like, actually.
Right.
Literally is orchestrating
the. The pervasive idea of an abusive godfather, that's God slash father, who sends his own kid to the cross so God could forgive people is nuts. Yeah, I've mentioned on Facebook, I've never heard anybody fairly represent penal substitutionary atonement who opposes it.
It always comes down to child abuse.
This doesn't make sense because you're not articulating it. It's not that the daddy God sent his own kid to kill his own kid.
Because he's just mean.
It's about God Himself, who is both Father and God is Son, and.
But they're not like here's another
distinct
little problem.
Persons, one
they're
being.
Not the same. You don't need the meme with that guy who's like, wait, God is the Father and the Son? So when when the Son prays to the Father, he's actually talking to himself?
Right.
He's not talking to himself.
I had interesting. So on that thread on Facebook, a guy said, you're making God into parts. If you say that God the Father exhausted his wrath on God the Son on the cross, you're making them like oppose each other. That's the whole point. They are not opposing each other. They're in perfect agreement. Perfect. Their wills are perfectly aligned, and they're one in being. it's not a separation in the Trinity. And if you can accept that the Son was sent by the Father to become incarnate. You can see there's a distinction in the persons that allows them to have different, to do different things, and to be in different roles, without having a separate, without parts. So if you allow for the incarnation, you have to also be able to allow for the atonement and the substitutionary aspect of it, and he just couldn't do it. But it always devolves into this child abuse stuff. Which is ridiculous. For me, the cross is an enactment of our human hatred. But what happens?
Our human hatred.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, it is an enactment
of our human hatred. Right.
She said something true.
We should go through and highlight the things that are actually true in black, and then for pink, things are kind of true, and then red, things that are certainly not true.
Oh, you mean the other way? I thought it was. Red, if it was true.
Oh, I forgot what it was, yeah.
Yeah, because Jesus' words are in red.
That's right.
And if they're not, if they're sort of Jesus' words, they're pink. And if they're not, they're gray.
Yeah.
And they're definitely not, then they're black.
Right. Okay, so for me, the cross is an enactment of our human hatred. But what happens on Easter is a triumph of love in the midst of suffering. Isn't that reason for hope? What happens
triumph
on Easter?
Who's...
Yeah, what happens on Easter? How if he's dead, tell us how it's the triumph of love in the midst of suffering. Isn't that reason for hope? No.
Not really.
Not if he's dead. There's no reason for hope. You alluded to child abuse. This is Nicholas Kristof again. So how do we reconcile an omnipotent, omniscient God with evil and suffering?
That's a good question too, Nicholas Kristof.
Yeah, yeah. At the heart of faith is mystery. Ah, there goes the liberal Protestant.
We don't know.
Run to mystery as fast as you can. Any theological question. It's all a big cloud. We don't know. We're just floating about in the sea of unknowing.
We have no idea why we're here or what we're supposed to be doing.
Why are we in this handbasket?
Where are we going? Where are we going and why are we in this handbasket? I don't know. And if you think you do know, you're kidding yourself. The people who actually do know what we're doing here are kidding themselves.
So God is beyond our knowing, not a being or an essence or an object.
Actually, he is a being.
And he's being a being. He is a being.
He is a being.
What?
He's a being.
What do you think he's a being?
He's actually three persons in one being.
Wait, so let's see what he's not, according to Serene. He's not a being or an essence.
Or an essence.
Or an object. What is he? What is that? What does it mean? What else is there?
He's like nothing.
What else is there?
He's like literally nothing. There is nothing there.
But I don't worship an all-powerful, all-controlling, omnipotent, omniscient being. That's true.
That's true. You don't. I think maybe what you're worshiping here as an Easter worshiper is yourself.
Right. So God's beyond our knowing. What? That's okay. What if he speaks? What if he says, "This is who I am"?
No.
His word becomes flesh and says,
no.
"This is me."
No. Kidding. You're kidding yourself.
That's not okay. So that's a fabrication. This idea of an all-powerful, all-controlling, omnipotent, omniscient being is a fabrication of Roman.
He's like all-controlling is kind of a mean word because that's not one of the words used. He's not all-controlling. Controlling abuser.
The Christian word is sovereign.
Sovereign.
That's a fabrication of Roman juridical theory and Greek mythology. Yeah, the Hebrew.
Juridical is kind of a big word there for you, lady.
If you go into the Old Testament, the Hebrew people tended to think that God was all-knowing and all-powerful and all-controlling.
All-controlling. And they were controlling.
Yeah, and
I just don't know why he has to be so controlling. It's awful.
And those Jews weren't too much into Roman juridical theory. Like Moses, I'm not sure, knew about Roman juridical theory.
Wait. Were there
or Greek mythology? No, Moses was big into Greek mythology. All that. And David. They're all worshippers of
Easter.
Hermes, right? So that's not the God of Easter.
Who's the God of Easter? Like, what are we? I've never heard of the God of Easter. Is that like Pan?
The God of Easter is vulnerable. And is connected to the world in profound ways that don't involve manipulating the world, but constantly inviting us into love, justice, and mercy. Well, what? How's that? Because he's not an essence, being, or an object. What? How does he
do
all
this
stuff?
How is he inviting?
Who did he send the invitation to? I don't remember getting.
I didn't get an invitation from the God of Easter.
You're cordially invited to constantly move into love, justice, and mercy.
Where did we get the categories of love, justice, and mercy from? I wonder, did we get those from the Greek mythology and the Roman juridical system? Where did those come from? I don't even know.
Nicholas Kristof asked him the question, isn't Christianity without a physical resurrection less powerful and awesome?
No.
Yeah, he gets on some level, Nicholas Kristof, he's a liberal, but
he's getting some good questions here.
When the message is about love, that's less religion, more philosophy.
What?
Exactly. When it's just love. Okay. Well, basically, Nicholas Kristof is saying, okay, well, basically we're saying makes Christianity into just
a philosophy,
a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of
like Buddhism,
not something grounded in an actual faith that God has acted in some way.
Well, that's manipulative. God is not manipulative. We know that he's not, so he is not going to act, because whenever you act, you're kind of being a jerk.
When you don't let me do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Or say I shouldn't do
I'm a worshiper of Easter, so...
Well, the Easter worshippers were bombed, and that's
yeah. Why doesn't everybody love them?
Yeah, that's yeah. For me, the message of Easter.
For me, every single answer called.
For me, the message of Easter is that love is stronger than life or death. Actually, no.
It really isn't, because if somebody dies, that's pretty devastating. That's it.
Love is done when that happens.
I mean, you can go on feeling love for them, but they're not there.
Well, that person's not loving. I mean, if
yeah,
nothing
happens, they're dead. They can't love you anymore.
Well, actually, death is stronger than love in that case. There's a much more awesome claim than that they put Jesus in the tomb 3 days, and 3 days later he wasn't there. For Christians for whom the physical resurrection becomes a sort of obsession, that seems to me pretty wobbly faith. What if tomorrow someone found the body of Jesus still in the tomb? Would that then mean that Christianity was a lie? Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what that would mean.
Exactly what that would mean. No, faith is stronger than that. Faith in what?
It's true, because atheists have to have the most faith. Like, they have to have the most awesome faith in order to keep going day by day.
Right. You have to because tell yourself there's story
nothing
after story
there.
After story, right?
Story. Mystery.
So I was saying, like, that's how this one another thing came up in Christian education. Yesterday is that we were talking about. I was asked, well, how do the liberal Protestants read through the Bible if they don't believe in miracles?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not what they do. And I don't think they read through the Bible, clearly.
Well, like, the old answer was they just found different explanations for things. So, you know, Jesus didn't really walk in the water, there was a sandbar. and he walked out to the disciples on a sandbar. And yeah, I guess he just didn't tell them.
Is full of sandbars. Yeah. That's one of the things that are there.
So, I guess he got in the boat and he just didn't tell them. Wow, Jesus, here, that's amazing. We were going to worship you. And he said, yep.
Yeah. That's a really horrible thing to do.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm awesome. And the wind, you know how the wind stopped? Like, it just randomly stopped.
It's a quinky dink.
And there was, I think it was him. And he's like, yeah, it was me.
It was me.
That's true. That's true.
So yeah, it's wobbly. So your faith has to be stronger than resting on things that the Bible says that Jesus did, like rise from the dead.
That's true.
So
that's
what true. What then? What faith in what? Faith in what?
Yourself.
You don't have any. There's no.
For me, my faith is about how I feel love for people who are dead. And I actually communicate with them beyond the grave through angel, like, energy that comes down my arm. And I wave my arm in the air, and I have, like, a force field for me. This is how it goes.
I mean, this is, you know, interestingly, this is a lot like what Andy Stanley says, actually. Because Andy Stanley says, your faith shouldn't rest in the Bible. Because that's wobbly faith. Because if your Bible is proven to be wrong about something, then your whole faith goes away. So you should rest your faith on the resurrection.
Of what?
Right. Where do we
resurrection?
Where? What? Because who tells us about the resurrection?
Yeah, I mean, and why would that? That's
the Bible.
An awkward thing to believe, just randomly, in a resurrection of somebody that you can't know about because you can't read any of the documents or the words that he said.
Yeah.
All the words he said about himself are obviously not interesting or true, and so I'm just gonna have resurrection.
Okay.
I like, if I found out that the resurrection wasn't true, I would stop being a Christian.
Yeah.
That is how weak my faith is. Or, I don't know, Buddhist, probably. I can move to Asia and eat really delicious food.
Yeah. We have to figure out which one works for us.
For me.
So, what about other miracles in the New Testament? This is Christoph. Say, the virgin birth. Good question. I find the virgin birth a bizarre claim. Yeah, it is bizarre.
Yeah.
That's I give that a pink. It is kind of true that it's bizarre.
It is a little bit crazy.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with Jesus' message. Well, he didn't actually...
He didn't talk about it?
He didn't... No, well, he didn't actually... I mean, it wasn't...
He wasn't, didn't lead with that? When he went through Galilee, he wasn't like, I just want all of you to know that God is my dad.
Right. Well, he did say that.
I mean, yeah,
I'm the son of God. But he didn't... What I meant by that is, since he was actually in the womb at the time, it wasn't like something that Jesus of Nazareth did. It was something that God the Son did. But anyway, so it has nothing to do with Jesus' message. What's Jesus' message?
I don't think she knows.
I've come to save you from your sins.
No.
It's, and part of the, where does sin come from?
For me, the message of Jesus is about global warming, right, and youth unemployment.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I forgot. So it has nothing to do with Jesus' message, except that Jesus' message is, I've come to save sinners, and where does sin come from? Jesus' message says sin comes from the heart, which means it's part of our nature. And so if it's part of our nature, how are we going to get rid of that stuff? Maybe if someone who is a new kind of human being who isn't born with original sin comes along, and he's also God.
No.
He might be able to do something about our nature being corrupted from the beginning of our conception.
No, obviously. I mean, the whole point of Jesus coming, and the only thing that we do know about him is that he was a Galilean peasant, born out of wedlock.
Buried in a shallow grave.
Is that, for me, the... I mean, he had a message of love that we don't know anything about because we don't know what he said.
Yeah.
And so, I'm actually out.
He's a lot like, you know what? I think he was a lot like Shereen Jones. Sounds like that's what...
Do you think we're saying her name right?
I don't know. I don't care.
That's bad.
Does she really... I mean... is she going to try and manipulate us by making this?
She has a weird little god in her attic upstairs.
So the virgin birth also only becomes important if you have a theology in which sexuality is considered sinful. What?
What? That's what the message of the virgin birth is that sexuality is sinful.
Does this person know? What's interesting about this, and this was true in Samaria too, is that there's a lot of scorn heaped on Orthodox theology from these kind of people, but they don't understand it. They can't articulate what it is. They have no idea. This one has no concept about what the doctrine actually teaches that she's mocking here. It has nothing to do with sexuality being sinful. It has to do with, yeah, the transmission of sin comes through sex, but that doesn't make sex itself sinful. She's not.
Because sin is given from one person to another through, by virtue of being alive, being a being, an essence, or a person. You know how all of humanity is like joined together and it's common. We're all, you know, different people, but we are joined together in our common humanity. Yes. And being sinful, and we pass on sin from one person to another, even in like the womb, which is not a, you know, that's a bad place too. It would have been better if Mary had decided not to have Jesus.
If she would have had the abortion.
Yeah.
An abortion. And Jesus would have just lived in her heart, you know.
Yeah.
Love.
Oh, gosh.
The love of...
I mean, that's a little bit more than blasphemous.
Love is love, though.
Love is love, though. So...
It also promotes this notion that the pure, untouched female body is the best body, and that idea has led to centuries of oppressing women.
No, actually, no, not female. The pure, untouched body of Jesus, who was sinless, like, that's the best body. It's not the female body. It's Lord Jesus. Right,
the virgin, you know. And there was, okay, now there was this thing growing up after Augustine, really, in Western Christianity that, you know, the pure virgin is always more holy than the non, than the married person.
Right.
Yeah, because there was this idea in Christianity, not in the scriptures, that sex carried with it always some kind of sin. And there is, of course, I mean, in everything we do carries with it some kind of sin, but that doesn't mean that sex inherently is sinful.
Or more, yeah, yeah, more than all the other things that we right. do are sinful. Like, right. everything we do is sinful, pretty much, so.
Right. And then I think that was kind of reemerged in the purity culture, right, with the, in evangelicalism.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because I was reading an article this morning about a woman who said, you know, she was raised, she remembers in youth group being told, imagine yourself in a white dress at your wedding day, and then imagine a red handprints everywhere boys touched you.
Oh my gosh.
Marring the dress.
What?
Marring the dress. Right.
That's horrible.
Right. So, well, and the whole purity rings and all of that. So,
yeah, that is so creepy. I do. It's true. So in Rebecca West's Black Lamb, Great Falcon, she goes and she kind of, it's such a fascinating book, but she spends, you know, a bunch of pages talking about the people in the Balkans, the Christians who, they were killed for, not being, like, for marrying. They were persecuted for 100 years for marrying, and then they came along, the culture changed, and they were persecuted for not marrying. What did I say? I probably said it backwards. So, like, there were couples who got married but remained chaste, as in they never came together in that way, and then they were persecuted for some number of years. But, like, it's flipped over.
Mm-hmm.
In this one really small town, there was sort of the remnants of this weird sexual change
over.
Backing back and forth.
Well, there, yeah, right.
No, that's all.
I think 4th-5th century, there was this idea that if you're married, the best way to do it is not to do it, to have sex, and Christians were encouraged to just not, which is crazy. It's absurd.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the Bible even remotely like that. The Bible's pretty bawdy when it comes to it comes to sexuality, and Paul chastises both men and women for refraining from their conjugal duties. If you want to fast for a small time for prayer, but then go back together because you're going to be tempted by Satan. So have sex. It's basically what he's telling married couples. And in fact, you know, it is, this purity culture thing is something that people have associated with the Puritans. But that...
Yeah, it's not...
The Puritans were pretty bawdy too. In fact, I was reading another article this week that a man was disfellowshipped, a Puritan man was disfellowshipped in the 17th century for not giving his wife conjugal rights. Like, she charged him publicly against the elders.
That's awesome.
And they disfellowshipped him because he wouldn't do it. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So anyway.
Well, anyway, yeah.
But no, the virgin birth is not the problem. That's not the problem.
That doesn't lead to centuries of oppressing women.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, imagine
maybe
that.
False deductions from it. Yeah.
Elevation of Mary to a status quite beyond what she might have expected as being the mother of the Lord. But she was oppressed. So, yeah.
Okay. Nicholas Christoph again. Prayer is is efficacious in the sense of making us feel better. But do you believe it is efficacious in curing cancer? I don't believe in a God who, because of prayer, would decide to cure your mother's cancer, but not cure the mother of your non-praying neighbor. We can't manipulate God like that. Again, with this God thing. What is this God you're talking about? And then secondly, if, you know, I know that she also doesn't believe in a God who is controlling stuff.
Because controlling things is
right?
bad.
So the way prayer actually works is that when you pray, God uses your prayers to do things he's already determined to do from the beginning of time. So he might have decided to heal your neighbor's mother from cancer with or without prayer. He can heal you with or without prayer. But sometimes he determines to use prayer to do things he's already determined to do. So that's why we pray. He doesn't tell us what those things are, so we pray for everything. But all that's very... So we're not... Even prayer is not manipulating God. It's it's petitioning God, asking God to do things in hopes that he will.
I mean, because God is by nature manipulative and horrible, living upstairs in your attic. Maybe you could whisper to him through the four floorboards, "Hey, God." I'd like to take issue with the prayer is efficacious in the sense of making us feel better.
Yeah.
Often prayer doesn't make you feel better. For me, prayer doesn't always make me feel better. Often it actually makes me more anxious because as I'm praying, more things come to my mind. The sense of need for a sovereign God who can bring about good in the midst of terrible suffering. It heightens my sense of the suffering, and it goes out. You know, as I'm praying for one person, somebody else comes to mind. I spend all day sort of on a praying for people who are in a bad way, and I don't feel better as I'm doing that. It has nothing to do, in fact, with how I'm feeling. I mean, I don't. That's where you go to the sovereign Lord of the universe who has power to act inside of his own creation.
And you're actually talking to a person, so there's
or a being or an essence.
Well, no, but there's so what that means is there's. I don't always want to talk to to a person about things.
Right. As like an introvert, I don't like to talk to people.
So there's a resistance in the human person, I think, for revealing your soul to somebody. And so prayer requires that of you.
So it doesn't always
It doesn't feel always something you want to do.
Nice.
Right. So
but sometimes it does.
Sometimes it does.
But that's not the point of it.
Like the thinking of like I always have this resistance in the morning before I pray. Because I know the first thing that the Anglican has to do in prayer is confess. So you've got to say, so I ask the Holy Spirit to bring to my mind all those things that I need to confess. And then I really don't want him to do it.
For me, no. Yeah. It feels crummy.
Right. It doesn't. It's not fun. That's not a fun part of prayer. But it does feel better afterwards, I guess. So what happens after we die? Let's stick with Christoph. And here's the question. I don't know. Who knows?
I don't know.
There may be something. There may be nothing.
Wow.
My faith is not tied to some divine promise about the afterlife. People who behave well in this life only to achieve an afterlife. That's a faith driven by selfish motive. Again, this person doesn't have any idea what classical Christianity teaches. Classical Christianity does not teach that you behave well in this life to get an afterlife.
Actually, that's the opposite.
Of what the gospel says. Has this person? I don't think this person knows that God has ever heard it.
No,
it's probably one thing to reject it
after hearing it.
But this person's never. I don't think this person has an idea. Quote: "I'm going to be good, so God will reward me with this stick of candy called heaven."
That's just the most random thing that you could say about Easter worshippers.
I mean, this is like a straw man of a straw man. This makes straw men look like
brick.
Yeah.
Houses of bricks.
This is, for me, living a life.
For me. She says it like in the middle of me. Yeah.
Living a life of love is driven by the simple fact that love is true. What is it? I want her to define this love thing that she keeps talking about.
I don't
think
you do want her to, though. I think you're going to be disappointed if she ever does that.
And I'm absolutely certain that when we die, there is not a group of designated bad people sent to burn in hell.
How is she absolutely certain about this?
Yeah, what?
She just said she didn't know.
Well, because she believes in love.
She said at the beginning she doesn't know what happens when you
die. I guess love wouldn't designate bad people to go to hell. And now she does have this certainty, or that doesn't exist. That hell does not exist. But hell has a symbolic reality. When we reject love,
how does she know
love,
this too?
She's making this stuff up. It's for me.
For me.
We create hell, and hell is what we see around us in this world today in so many forms. I would say Union Seminary is one form.
One of those forms of hell that we see today. looking for
hell. If you're looking for a form of hell,
sign up for a master's.
When we reject divinity. Love. and that's true.
I wonder what the divinity is about in their MDiv.
Who knows? I mean, for me.
For me.
So, yeah, so who knows? Who knows after we die? Maybe nothing.
When we die.
Maybe something.
Poor Nicholas Kristof, because I wonder if he really wanted to know. Like,
yeah, I feel bad for the guy.
Maybe I want to go to heaven. No, I don't know. And a Google search, depending on what you've searched before, isn't going to give him the answer either.
So I've asked this of other interviewees in this religion series. Yeah. For someone like myself, who is drawn to Jesus' teaching, but doesn't believe in the virgin birth or the physical resurrection, what am I? Am I a Christian?
Am I a tree? What kind of tree am I?
See, this is what always perplexes me. People say they've clearly not read the New Testament. They've clearly not read what Jesus actually says in the Gospels. Things like, if you don't hate your mother and father and brother and sister and whatever, and take up your cross and follow me.
You cannot be my disciple.
You cannot be my disciple. Or, I've not come to bring peace to the world, but a sword. And I can't wait. I'm bringing fire to the earth, and I can't wait till it's kindled. I mean, really? Is that really what he likes, the teaching of Jesus? Or how about when Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am? Or things like, the Son of Man is the Lord over the Sabbath. Things that like clearly point to his divinity. He doesn't really like Jesus' teaching either. So it's not just he weeds out the miracles. He weeds out
almost all the teaching.
Yeah, almost all the teaching too. I mean, I'm not sure what part of Jesus' teaching does he like.
For me, the part that's like just those few verses. I don't actually know where they are. Where he healed that one person that one time. For me, that's the part. Well, except he didn't heal because he doesn't do miracles. Right. It felt nice when I read the story, so that's the part.
It was healing touch.
It was
therapeutic. So the leper said, oh, someone's...
I feel
strangely warm.
Strangely warm. Like, is it the Biden Jesus? Is that the kind? For me, Jesus is upstairs and he's like Biden. So his healing touch... creeps me out.
All right, so he said, so I want to read his question again because your response is classic. I've asked this of other interviewees in this religion series. For someone like myself who is drawn to Jesus' teaching but doesn't believe in the virgin birth or the physical resurrection, what am I? Am I a Christian? Well, you sound an awful lot like me. And I'm a Christian minister. No,
okay,
you're not.
Then.
No, you're not a Christian minister. You're something.
You're something.
Not a Christian. She's a Gnostic. She's a Gnostic is what she is.
She's a Gnostic minister.
But she's not as smart as the Gnostics were in the third
Gnostics
century.
Yeah, the Gnostics were really intelligent people.
I often feel like we're in the middle of another Reformation in a 500-year cycle. John Calvin and Martin Luther had no idea they were in the middle of a Reformation, but they knew that the church structures were breaking down, new forms of communication were emerging, and new scientific discoveries were being made, new kinds of authorities and states and economic systems arising, all like this moment in time. This creates a spiritual crisis and a spiritual flexibility. So she's like Martin Luther and John Calvin, except without the Bible stuff.
And without the intelligence.
Yeah, and you know, this amazing, this is like a revival of, I mean, those... Union Seminary and the pastors that go from Union Seminary. I mean, those are among the most fastest growing congregations in the world. I mean, people are just flocking to hear people talk about the non-essence, non-being love that is being preached there. And that's like revolutionizing.
It is. The landscape of Easter worshiping.
I mean, the Episcopal Church, I mean, they have to like bar the doors to keep people out now because
they actually they need to start charging admission
because it's so
for their Easter services. Maybe they would grow if they charged a little bit of admission for that.
People might think, hey, there's something there.
Maybe I should pay.
Right. So she's this is exactly what John Spong was saying. You know, we're in a new age.
And how long ago was that?
This
was
like two decades ago. This was in the 80s.
It's just awful.
And we live in a time with motor cars and
What is this?
And electricity.
Motorized, this horseless carriage.
And in such an age, no one would ever believe in such primitive notions as resurrection and virgin birth. That was his thing. So if we're going to grow, if we're not, why Christianity? This was the premise of his book. Why Christianity must change or die.
It's definitely dying.
And so, as the Bishop of New Jersey, like people were like fleeing out of his churches. They were like, they were racing to see who could leave faster. It was literally dying in New Jersey. The longer he was there, he smashed it under his feet. So okay. Yeah, she goes on. Christianity is at something of a turning point.
What's something? It is something of a turning point.
She's making all these propositional statements about things.
How does she know any of this stuff?
But I think that this questioning and reaching out, I think this questioning and this reaching is even bigger than Christianity. It reaches into many religious traditions. This wrestling with climate change. What? And wrestling with levels of violence in our world, and wrestling with authoritarianism and the intractable character of gender oppression. It's forcing communities within all religions to say, something's horribly wrong here. Yeah, see, you know, there's nothing more authoritarian than a woman like this in power.
Well, yeah.
Not just a woman. When it comes,
any person
like this in power is the most authoritarian being you'll ever meet. Because there is no room for any other way of thinking.
Because she knows so many things that are just random and...
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But the biggest problem is climate change, clearly.
Yeah.
That's our biggest problem. Is today Earth Day?
Is it? No. Is it?
I thought it was Earth Day.
When is Earth Day?
If so, we should make sure to spray some hairspray.
No, just stop. You can't buy hairspray.
Start turning on all the lights in the house.
No, because then our energy...
Borrow an SUV and go drive around.
You should learn your daughter to drive today.
Teach.
No, that in our family we say, learn. Daddy, when are you going to learn me to drive? And you're like, tomorrow. Because of your intractable gender oppression, I don't have time to learn you to drive.
We need a new way entirely to think about what it means to be a human being. And what the purpose of
our
lives
is.
That's
true. Like, I don't know what the purpose of her life is. And I think she should think about
it. Yeah, she should really think about it because she doesn't know where she's going. Know what she's doing. This is about love, man. For me, this moment feels apocalyptic.
It sure does.
Yes.
It really,
now, that's
really does.
True. As if something new.
For me, it also feels apocalyptic. As an Easter worshiper, this moment feels...
The wrath of God is being revealed
from on high in a way that I had hoped I would never see with my own eyes.
Against all the ungodliness, wickedness of men, who suppress the truth with her.
They're really stupid teaching.
As if something new is struggling to be born.
Yeah, but it's just not being born.
Yeah.
It's like so many who struggle to be born and then just don't make it out alive.
Like 2,000 years ago?
Says Nicholas Kristof.
Yes, something was struggling to be born in that first Easter.
What?
It burst forth in ways that changed the world. What is that? It's so irrational. So what she wants us to believe is that Jesus really was crucified, lynched, right?
Yeah.
On Friday. But then on Easter morning, what? That
they just rose suddenly, again in our hearts.
They just felt better?
They felt better. Like... Even less than 24. I mean, he died on Friday afternoon, and already by dawn on Sunday morning, they felt better.
Love wins.
Because when people die, for me, when people I love die, it just definitely takes me like one day to feel the resurrection in my heart as an Easter worshiper. It takes me less than 24 hours to feel better every time someone dies. Or something bad happens, you know, the intractable violence of our time. When a lot of people are killed, for me, I feel the resurrection immediately.
See, when you die, I think I'll get remarried.
Just like
in 24 hours.
It's the resurrection. Love wins.
Right.
I mean, that is absurd.
I should think about who I'd want to remarry.
You should get
in 24
right.
hours.
In 24 hours.
After you die.
I don't think you have to marry, though. I think you, because of,
you know, you should just go on with your life like nothing happened, because you really,
get on Tinder.
Because we're resurrection people.
Yeah, we're resurrection
people. Get on Tinder.
I mean, that's absurd. That is absurd. They watched him die, and then they did not just feel better because of
love.
A new life bursting forth in ways to change the world forever.
That doesn't even make it's just, this
it
must,
is the dumbest thing ever.
Asinine is the word I would use. But yeah, okay, so today I feel that spiritual ground is shaking around us again. The structures of religion as we know it have become bankrupt and are collapsing.
Yeah, that's true.
She says.
I mean,
and
you couldn't have said a more true
in the bastion
thing.
Of liberal Protestantism.
The structures of religion are collapsing.
Yes, they are. What will emerge? That is for our children and our children's children to envision and build.
Like the spire of Notre Dame falling over and over and over again.
That was what we experienced much, just a lot of in the Episcopal Church. That was our experience of the Episcopal Church. And if you could encapsulate in one article
everything that made me so sad about going to seminary, that was it.
Yeah.
So I think we should transition, in more ways than one. I really wanted to do a post-Easter or Holy Week breakdown. I really want to,
because we've already been talking for almost an hour.
Well, I just listened to a podcast that lasted for 2 hours recently.
Really?
And everything that, do you want to, shall we do that later this week?
Yeah, let's do a live stream video.
Of our post-Easter wrap up. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and that's good because the dog has come to be with us now.
And
you'll
hear a lot of licking sounds.
Well, on that note, thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.